Live to see it, friends, and welcome to The World Transformed. This program is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead, one that will be here sooner than you think, and one that you have an important role to play in bringing about. At The World Transformed, we want to introduce you to what may be the greatest transformation of them all, the one that begins with considering and acting on the almost limitless possibilities that lie before us and that ends somewhere beyond the reach of the human imagination. So, when does this amazing future begin? Well, today is the day. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
Well, I am super fantastic. How are you, my friend?
Man, I am doing great. Happy Friday.
Happy Friday to you. We've been having a fun week working our way through signs of the times, talking about how current news stories prove that various future scenarios are being lived out even as we speak. And we're gonna wrap that up this week with our favorite thing. Our Friday feature, Other Geek, takes over the whole show tonight because we're going to take some current news stories and prove and show how they prove that we're living in various science fiction stories.
Yep, and let's just jump right into it, Phil.
You know, this can't wait, right? We can't no preliminaries on this. Let's begin. The first science fiction story that we're living in, and here's absolute evidence from National Geographic, is Jurassic Park. Yes, the Jurassic Park future is coming true. The headline is First Dinosaur Tail Found Preserved in Amber. And this is a really awesome story. They have found a dinosaur tail. It's got feathers. It's got soft tissues. This actually goes one better than Jurassic Park, if I recall the novel. I don't take the explanation for how things worked in the movie too seriously, but in the book, as I recall, they may have discussed this in the movie too, the way they got soft tissues from dinosaurs was they got blood from like insects that had bitten dinosaurs that were preserved in amber, right? I don't know, was that in the movie? Maybe it was, yeah.
Yeah, that was in the movie. So it was they drill into this amber and extract from the gut of mosquitoes.
Right.
A
little bit of blood that was
blood
in there.
Yeah, so that they could then sequence the dinosaur. Hey, we got a whole tail here. And
yeah.
I love that it's covered with feathers because, think about it. I mean, think of the animals in the world, Phil. How many of them are running around like naked mole rats, right? I mean, with nothing on them, no hair, no feathers, no nothing. Practically every animal has, armor, in the case of like crocodiles and things like that, or like a turtle with a shell, or hair, or feathers in the case of birds. Why in the world would we think any different of dinosaurs? Yet Jurassic Park and all these movies, all the dinosaurs are naked, right? And they have nothing. And I think that this discovery, may take some time for us to get our current vision of what dinosaurs look like out of our heads. But I think this discovery may do it. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that's entirely possible. Here it is. It's got feathers. I mean, one of the things that's really interesting about the Jurassic Park movies is that they reflected cutting edge understandings of dinosaurs as it was understood at the time. And you can see how much it's changed over the years by looking at how the dinosaurs are portrayed. And when Michael Crichton wrote the novel originally, he knew that his readers were going to be familiar with one set of ideas about dinosaurs, and he had to introduce them to another set of ideas. The fact that they were probably warm-blooded was a completely unexpected idea for a lot of people. They hadn't heard that's where paleontology was leaning. Lots of stuff about T-Rex behavior that's in there, about raptor behavior. What's funny is I don't think it's in the movies. It might be. I might be confusing the movies and the books here a little bit. But in one of the subsequent movies or books, there's a scene where somebody goes, "That's okay. He can't see unless you move, right?" And then the T-Rex just eats him. Right? Like, paleontology came along and it's like, oh, It turns out they probably could see even if you couldn't move. We're not as sure about that one as we used to be. But one of the things that's become abundantly evident, and for the reasons that you just said, is that dinosaurs were almost certainly covered with feathers. That's why birds have them, right? That's just the case. So this picture we've had of dinosaurs since the 19th century, of these kind of smooth, lizardy creatures, is probably inaccurate. That by and large, most of them were probably very feathery-looking creatures. And when they made Jurassic World, they knew that, but they couldn't make that leap, right? That was too far to go. The world is ready for a lot of things, but I think feathery dinosaurs, it wasn't quite ready for. If they make another one, or if somebody else makes a movie about what dinosaurs used to look like, I hope we start to see that, because that's reality, right? I mean, it's as best as we understand it now, anyhow.
Well, I think there's a picture with this story, Phil. This National Geographic story has a picture of a feathered covered dinosaur artist conception, right? Mm-hmm. And I thought it was a pretty great picture. The more that people see this, particularly young people, and their conception of dinosaurs changes, I think our popular conception of dinosaurs in movies and things like that will change too. And I look forward to seeing a Jurassic Park type movie with feathery dinosaurs, you know. Yeah, and actually it's the one of the first images you see there in this article is a feathery dinosaur. Looks
well,
neat.
Looks I like mean, a, my first take on this feathery dinosaur, everybody check it out. It's kind of cute, right? I think
until he wants to eat you, yeah.
Well, I'm not saying I want to face him down, but in the picture, it's kind of lovable looking. You could make a plush toy out of this dinosaur. I mean, kids love dinosaurs anyway, but I think feathered dinosaurs, there's a real marketing opportunity for somebody who wants to start, who wants to productize this. If you look at him, I think the feathered dinosaur is going to be a big hit in years to come. In fact, if I were so inclined, I think I'd write a children's book and develop a line of toys around feathered dinosaurs. Somebody listening picks up on that, run with it, make your first million, send me $1,000, okay? That's
and a mention in the Ford,
Yeah, that's right. Just, say the world transformed, and it was mostly Phil, not really Stephen. I think it would be important to say that.
Stephen, not so much.
But you know what's cool is looking at these pictures, this picture of this tail, which is just awesome. Look what's right above the tail. Isn't that an ant?
Yeah.
Going back
a
to
huge ant.
Yeah, the original Michael Crichton thing. It's like, who knows what kind of interesting DNA might be floating in the gut of that ant, in addition to all the DNA that we've got in this potentially that we've got in encased in this dinosaur tail. So, what do you think? Do you think that we'll actually see this happen? Will somebody try to take soft tissue from encased in amber and really make a dinosaur? When are we really living in Jurassic Park?
Well, I don't know, Phil, because what I have heard, and this was probably 3 or 4 years ago, is that DNA, best case scenario, is probably has broken down, to the point that it can't be used if it's older than, 40 or 50,000 years. And so that would allow us to bring back mammoths and various things various interesting animals like that from the Ice Age, but wouldn't allow us to go much further back than that. Now that the thing is, technology always marches on. Our ability to even if what we're getting is just little pieces of DNA, eventually if you get enough of it and you can put it together in some way that makes sense. Maybe using birds as the analog, say, okay, well, yeah, we know this based on bird DNA. We know this goes here, and these broken down pieces. You put them back together like a jigsaw puzzle. Maybe you get something at some point.
Right.
So I'm not ready to rule out that we won't see a Jurassic Park at some point. But it seems like we're likely to see an Ice Age Park much sooner. With mammoths and things like that.
That's almost Saber-tooth certainly tiger. True. And in the novel, the original novel, I think Crichton was aware to some extent of that problem of DNA decay, and he addressed it with filling the gaps using, I don't know why, frog DNA. Well, I guess maybe because that allowed for the changing of sexes between the two kinds of dinosaurs changing, becoming male when they needed male dinosaurs to start them reproducing. But I think you're right. It would be more likely that we'd fill in those gaps using bird DNA than frog DNA. Although there could be a case to be made either way. Yeah, probably a few years off. We're not exactly living in Jurassic Park yet.
Yeah, we see our Ice Age Park first, I think. Yeah.
I think that's true. But we're closing in. You know, it's closer than we were. And we got this one paleontologist here with this really interesting quote. Maybe we can find a complete dinosaur. That'd be a big piece of amber and a small dinosaur. But wouldn't that be cool if they?
Yeah, that would be great.
If they do find that, we'll learn a lot more about the structures of dinosaurs' bodies and what they were really like. And even if the only way we ever get Jurassic Park is virtual reality, at least that eventual virtual reality environment is going to be a lot more accurate based on discoveries like this. Okay, so maybe we're living in Jurassic Park, maybe not. Now I've got, you know, the downside here. In our three-act play, Act Two is where everything goes south on us. So I've got two short stories, one of which was a classic Twilight Zone episode. The first one we've talked about on the show before, I Have No Mouth and I Must Scream by Harlan Ellison, one of the most dystopian and horrifying science fiction stories ever written. The other one, It's a Good Life by Jerome Bixby. Have you read that story, Stephen, or have you seen the Twilight Zone episode?
I've seen the Twilight Zone episode. I've not read the story.
Oh, okay. Yeah, the Twilight Zone episode captures it. I mean, it absolutely captures it. I'm going to come back to how these relate. Let's just talk about the actual news headline here at first, because this is a great development. We've been talking about how wonderful AI is, and here's a headline for you. This AI's attempt to write a Christmas carol is absolutely bone-chilling. This is from the AV Club, a spinoff from The Onion. But this is not exactly a humor piece. They're talking about how some AI researchers in Canada have developed this technology called Neural Karaoke, and they've taught the computer how to write a song. After looking at a photo, which is an interesting way of doing it anyhow, but obviously it's, you know, there's some deep learning involved, and it's clearly drawing on a huge database of existing Christmas carols, both the lyrics and the melody. But it's also generating its own material.
Well, I think at the risk of creeping our audience out, I think we just need to play it, Phil. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that's a great idea. Let's just... let's take a moment here and let's give a listen to an AI's attempt to spread a little holiday cheer. Check it out.
To decorate the room, the Christmas tree is filled with flowers. I swear, 'tis Christmas Eve. I hope that is what you say. The best Christmas present in the world is a blessing. I've always been there for the rest of our lives.
Mom, I'm scared. Okay. What's funny is I don't know that I would have found that frightening had it not been introduced by a headline that talked about how frightening it was. I would have found it just kind of bizarre and off-putting, maybe.
Yeah, it was bizarre, and I'm going to tell you, you know what it reminded me of? It reminded me of a little kid banging away on a piano, just, you know, throwing out phrases. And, you know, kids, when they're, I mean, very small children, like 4 and 5 years old, when they try to come up with a song that's just completely original, right?
Yeah.
It's something like this usually. It's weird and a little bit creepy, and that's why, you know, invariably, if there's singing going on in the creepy part of a horror movie, it's always a little kid singing, right? And so, being the father of four, and I know, Phil, you're father as well, you know that, you know, when kids try their, you know, first efforts at making music, it's not too unsimilar to this. This is not that creepy, is it?
What's creepy is that it's not a kid. I think that's what makes it creepy. Yeah, I think perhaps if the author of this piece had heard a kid, maybe right before writing this, they would not have had quite such a strong reaction. But in light of their reaction, in light of the fact that it is childlike, that got me to thinking. You know, we've been talking an awful lot about the tremendous power that AI is going to be taking on, right? And what if AI is, you know, in a position to pretty much take over the world, and it's trying to do good things, but its attempts at doing good things are kind of like this Christmas carol.
Yeah, I'm with you now. The creep factor, I just had some chills go up my spine. Yeah, I see what you're saying, you know.
Yeah, you know, so the example I gave from It's a Good Life.
Stephen
those
likes
seen,
pancakes. Let's force feed Stephen, you know.
I'm going to put Stephen in a virtual
pancakes.
Environment where he's going to do nothing but eat pancakes for a billion years, okay? That's how much I love Stephen, right?
Yeah, exactly.
That's trying to do something good. And that's kind of where it's a good life meets I Have No Mouth and I'm a Scream. For those who don't know, It's a Good Life, that story is about a town where this kid, for whatever reason, has paranormal powers. He basically, anything he thinks becomes reality. And because he's
God-like.
Not a particular... Yes, he's got godlike powers. And because he's not a particularly nice kid, horrible, horrible things happen. And the townspeople... are simply trying their best to appease this child who can destroy them at any moment. It's a great story. It's a wonderful Twilight Zone episode because of the performances.
And it was also remade into the Twilight Zone movie. A segment of the Twilight Zone movie has a remake of it, which is it's really creepy.
It's very disturbing. I think they toned it down. They gave it a happy ending. Sorry for the spoiler there, but you know, they gave it a more upbeat ending because it was, you know, Spielberg, and he makes family movies and all that kind of stuff. And it took some of the edge off it. But some of the stuff that goes on in that one is just like, whoa, you know, this like cartoonish crazy stuff, which is exactly what you would expect from a kid. Right. He sees the world in cartoon terms, and he's going to make things happen along those lines. That's, you know, that's one possibility where we end up with AI, right? Where we give AI tremendous power, and it decides, well, I'm going to, you know, here's how I see the world. So you better play along or else. And of course, in Harlan Ellison's story, I Have No Mouth and I Must Scream, you've got an AI that just basically hates humans. It's almost kind
keeps
of
keeps humans around just to torture. It's destroyed most of the human race, but just the remaining people around just to be tortured.
Yeah, and it's not even trying to do anything
story.
Good. Yeah,
yeah, it's an awful story. Don't read this one at bedtime, folks. I'm telling you.
No, neither one of them is particularly great for bedtime. Although, if you want to creep yourself out, you know, just sit in a dark room and watch that old Twilight Zone episode. It's it will get you. And the kid in it, Billy Mumy, he was also in Lost in Space, for those who, since this is Other Geek Night on The World Transformed, I think that's probably worth pointing out. You know, we're probably overdoing the fear thing on this. However, it does speak to the limitations of AI, at least as we're currently conceiving it. When it's good, it's great, and when it's not good, it's kind of weird.
It turns out there's an uncanny valley for this sort of stuff. I mean, Christmas Carols has an uncanny valley. Who knew? Now we know.
Now we know.
Yeah.
First we get the movie The Polar Express, which shows us the uncanny valley, and now we've got A Christmas Carol showing. What this odd relationship is between Christmas and the uncanny valley, we'll have to explore another time, but there seems to be something there. Okay, so moving on, let's swing it back to a more uplifting and positive view of the future from science fiction. Contact. We talked about how technology is moving us closer to a scenario where we have potentially one day first contact with an alien civilization on Wednesday's show. And here, I'm talking about the movie Contact, and also the novel by Carl Sagan, Contact, in which a very advanced alien civilization reaches out to humanity, and spoiler, so just stop right here if you've never read the book or seen the movie, and shame on you. The big reveal at the end of the book, anyway, is that the universe we live in, is a constructed place, that that there is a code written into the universe showing, you know, mathematically, that we were built by somebody else, right? In the book, it's a string of digits in pi that form a circle, occurring much earlier than anything like that should be showing up in the digits of pi. So it shows that this universe was specifically created to reveal itself to somebody smart enough to do the math. And, you know, here we are not even looking for it, but wow, check this out. Humans and supernova-born neutron stars have similar structures. Now, I'm saying that this would be a better way to reveal that the universe is a designed place by some advanced alien civilization than even putting digits in pi, right? This is pretty cool. What am I reaching too digits, far with that one, Stephen, or what do you
think? Yeah, put the digits in pi, you know, hi, Mom, you know.
Yeah.
Some kind of, you know, I guess. This is pretty remarkable. Now, it could just come out, you know, I guess we need to explain how they're similar, neutron stars and cells. How are they similar according to this article?
Yeah, well, first off, follow the link and look at the picture, and you'll see, well, those two things do kind of look alike. And it's interesting that you're looking at very different scales of structures there. But we've got a material inside our cytoplasms, inside our cells, that it's these little helixes connecting stacks of evenly spaced sheets, okay? So our cells are made up of structures that look like that. They're called Terasaki ramps. Now, if you look inside a neutron star, okay, there is a set of structures that they call nuclear pasta, and it's got a very, very similar shape. So what holds a neutron star together structurally is very similar to what holds a human cell cytoplasm together. You know, so we're talking very small, organic, biological structure and massive, huge astronomical structure. They look a lot alike, or at least more alike than you might expect.
Looks like a multi-story parking garage. You could,
yeah,
you could,
yeah.
If you were driving a car up this, you could park along any of the, and that's what the structure looks like. It looks like multiple stories of a parking structure connected by ramps going up, right? So
exactly.
And so, you know, these things are, you know, planetary sized, and I guess these structures would be as big as planets inside of the neutron star, and tiny, tiny, tiny in our cells. So that's interesting. That's very interesting. You know, Carl Sagan would love this, wouldn't he? He's the one that used to say that we were made of star stuff anyway, right? Because
that's right.
Atoms in our body came from the stars, but this is structures. So yeah, he would love this.
Here, the star stuff that makes us up reveals itself a little bit, right? It shows that ultimately it is star stuff. Now, is this any kind of evidence that we're living in a contact-like universe? Okay, probably not. You know, I mean, I like to point to something like this. But if really you were going to look for evidence that we live in the contact-type universe, I would say it's that Fibonacci spiral, right? That mathematical construct that just seems to show up everywhere, right? These interesting you know, shapes in galaxies and shapes in tiny little microscopic creatures and everything in between, right? Seems to follow that sequence of numbers and seems to assume that shape. But probably what these kinds of, not even coincidences, but these kinds of reuse of the same principles tells us is just that there's, you know, there's some underlying math that guides the universe, and there's the math, right? It's like a visible proof that the same sets of numbers that do one thing are pretty much doing something else. If you want to take that as evidence that some advanced alien programmed the universe, okay. But it could also
be that that's just the way things work. You know, this is the way things usually work out, right?
And yeah, it's just there's a certain integrity to how the, you know, how the math plays out in the universe, and here's more evidence of that. But you know, that's not as much fun. I'm not saying it has to be aliens, but it ought to be aliens, I guess.
or a matrix, right? So, you know, we're living in the matrix. Well, you know, what it was about 6 months ago, Phil, that Elon Musk came out saying, yeah, we're almost definitely in the Matrix, right?
And, right, that's right.
And he gave reasons. So, yeah, I invite our audience to Google that. That's pretty interesting. He had, and you know, very smart guy. He has his reasons for thinking that. So, I don't think that was just him being funny. I think he actually believes that there's real evidence of it. So, check that out.
Well, one thing that you can say, I mean, in terms of signs of the times, when I first read Contact, that idea that the whole universe might be some alien construct, might be some construct from an advanced mind, not referencing religion, not talking about God, but talking about how our entire universe might be some kind of artifact, was a completely new idea to me.
Yeah.
I don't think I had ever encountered that anywhere else, even in as wild as the sequels to 2001 A Space Odyssey get. I don't think Arthur C. Clarke ever pushed it quite that far. But today, that is a fairly common idea. Yeah, you got people like Elon Musk saying, yeah, that's probably true. And others, Neil deGrasse Tyson, following suit, came out and said that he thinks we're probably living in a computer simulation recently. Now, computer simulation is different from what Carl Sagan was hinting at in that book, but it's not that different. You know, that computer simulation would be the easy way, I guess, to build a
universe. It's compatible with Sagan's idea. Sagan's vision is compatible with the computer simulation idea. Put it that way. Sagan, he was a big picture guy. You know, the billions and billions thing. I mean, he really he had. I think he had a real sense of awe and wonder as he looked out on the night sky, and he was able to communicate that so well in his books and in his TV show and everything else. He just he has inspired a lot of science fiction authors as well as scientists, what an impact, right?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. You know, a real a wonderful combination of sticking just to the science and showing with imagination how far that can take you. I think that he demonstrated that as well as anybody ever could. You don't have to step outside of what many would consider a fairly limited kind of materialist worldview that he had to come up with some really mind-blowing scenarios, right? So some really amazing kinds of ways the future can unfold.
You know, that was sort of similar to the inspiration that began our podcasting, Phil. It was, you know, listening to the
Art Bell Show. Yeah, absolutely.
The Art Bell Show, and I got the idea. Well, you know what? What if we did Phil and I just did the Art Bell Show, but constrained ourselves to the science?
Yeah.
And
here's the
result. Here's the result. And so do we get out there and wacky and have a good time with it? You bet we do. I mean, it turns out the real world is a pretty astounding place, and it's kept us busy enjoying that for how many years now, Phil? It looks like
13,
about 11, 12 years.
12, yeah. 12 years,
something
yeah.
Like
12 years.
12 years now.
And,
yeah.
And more than 550 shows. And we carry on. So just let that I think that's a great way to close that out. No idea that you encounter in this world is so strange that there might not be a good rational explanation for it that we can back into eventually. I guess that's kind of where we're going. That the Art Bell stuff in the end proves kind of tame compared to what just you know, a scientific view of the universe might give us. Although we do love the Art Bell stuff too, so don't we do. Don't despair.
We're not too good for that.
we'll be coming back to that stuff too. We'll do a Tales of the Paranormal Friday, one of these other Geek Weeks, and have some fun with that stuff too. But this has been a good week. I've enjoyed looking at the signs of the times, and the best news is, Stephen, guess what? There'll be more signs next week, and we'll keep tracking with those as well.
Awesome. Awesome.
All right. Well, hey, it's been great talking with you. It's been great having you all with us. Thanks so much. We look forward to being with you again next week. And until next time, live to see it.